So, good evening, or morning, or afternoon. It's afternoon, actually. Afternoon, 15:13 hours of April 1st in the year 2024 of the Common Era. Ward Green with you again. And it's interesting that I wasn't aware whether it was morning, afternoon, or evening. Of course, I know what time it is. It's just that sometimes the brain is disconnected from the vocal cords, you know, if you know what I mean. In another all-time first in history, we started studying chapter 9, paragraph 11 of the Crucible article, and we're now down to the second part. One generation prior to year 17 of Pharaoh Simon, another priestly induction is recorded on 1 Shemu 20, the Egyptian month, first Shemu, also called Passion, the 20th day of that month, in year 2 of Osorkon the Elder, who ruled 6 years from Africanus and Eusebius, both. They're from Dynasty, right here, Dynasty 21, 6 years from both of them, for Osorkon the Elder, also called Osakor, and this date corresponding to January 22nd from the year 1032 to 1029 BCE in the Egyptian calendar. There are 4 years for a given Julian date because the Egyptian calendar does not have a leap year. And it doesn't adjust every 4 years like the Julian calendar does. So year one of Simon is from 1009 plus 16, or 1025, which we, later on in the Trojan War article, we lower it to 1024 BCE, but it's a very tight-fitting chronology. And Osorkon precedes Simon, who began in 1025, according to what we just said. So, with 1025 BCE as year 6 of Osorkon, 1029 looks like an obvious candidate for year 2. And I say here, except that the new moon of January 20th of that year is 2 days too early. Let's look at the new moon of that year. In the year 1029, January 22nd is Passion 20, which is first Shemu 20. It's the correct Egyptian day in the year 1029 BCE. And we use the convention that the numbers are the same in the BCE instead of the scientific convention that minus 1028 would be the year 1029 BCE in the scientific convention. But we use the same number, minus 1029, for 1029 BCE, simpler that way. And January 22nd. Is lunar day 3 here. So that's what I was complaining about. It's not lunar day 1, but that's fine. It can still be fine for a priestly induction. If we go back, we see lunar day 1 was actually near midnight on January 20th, 2 days previous, which is so close to midnight that it could easily be that it was in the Egyptian time, even though that's local time in Egypt. 11:38 p.m. in Egypt, still, it's possible that this lunar day 3 is actually only lunar day 2 because the nearness to midnight could make lunar day 1 the 21st. So this could be still a very good day for induction, so there's no problem really with the fit. But I was looking for an exact lunar day 1 here. And so to change by 3 days, you have to go, you know, by 3 days in the lunar calendar, you have to go 3 years in the calendar. So I raised things up so that year one of Osorkon was 1034 BCE instead of 1030, which we later decided, well, it's, you know, 3 or 4 years different, right? His reign length expanded, but 1031 could be the correct year, because in the, there's an error. I should note the error. I say 1028 for the year two in the Trojan War article, and that's a mistake. It should be 1029, not 1028, because I probably made the same mistake with the lunar, I mean, with the lunar day one being in a certain year. I was using scientific convention, saying, well, minus 1028 according to some scientific paper or scientific table, and I misread it as 1028 instead of 1029, because their convention differs from ours. But the miracle moon appears to be, then I said 1032, but none of this applies in the later article, so it's still 1029 for the miracle moon, or the actual day of the induction. Okay, and this is one generation later, right? 1020, or this is prior, rather. It's one generation previous to the year 17 of Simon, which we said dates to 1009, even though it doesn't look like that's year 17. That's the best choice, it looks like. December 28th, 1009 for that induction. So this is, 1029 is 20 years earlier, so that's a short generation, but we don't know the exact age of the priest necessarily, but it could have been a difference in age, but it's the, you know, if they were the same age, it's a 20-year generation. So the priest had a son when he was 20 years old, which is fine, but it doesn't happen every generation that way. At least we don't think so, but it's just human nature. The firstborn son is typically at age 27 of the father, on average. But the final analysis, as we continue on here, the dead reckoning gets us with Pharaoh Amenemope, 9 years, and Susen the first, 46 years. We go from, we added 55 years onto 1033, which we said was 1033 was year one in this article of Osorkon the Elder, so it should be 3 years lower. But then we're ignoring the 4 years of Amenemnisu in this article, so it gets us back again to the same approximate location. The 26 years of Pharaoh Smendes takes us to 1114, because we've ignored the 4 years of Amenemnisu, and we've added 3 years instead. So we're 1 year lower than we end up being at 1115 in the later article, so that's just worth paying attention to the differences. But we've ignored Amenemnisu, or Neferkeres, in other words, whom we treat as an ephemeral king in this article. So the limitations of dead reckoning are no guarantee of this result, so requiring us to obtain a means of confirmation. This we do by computing from the date of the Exodus downwards, pausing to properly decode Egyptian chronology. First, what gives us the confidence of our conviction that the date 1114 BCE is an acceptable Pharaoh Smendes year one, the date we later call 1115? First, we simply accept the accurate Bible-based crucible. After that, we found good agreement for lunar dates, which were provided out of a documented Egyptian religious zeal. Their zeal for the their festivals of the new moon, the five-day festivals, lunar day one through lunar day five. We were further encouraged by the disagreement amongst the Egyptological authorities, who differed on many key dates. That these things have not been established clearly may be seen from the difference of Middle Eastern chronologies of a full 64 years between the low and middle chronologies, a rift bigger than we need in which to hole up our crucible. We are not about to consider the so-called high chronology. Should we develop it correctly, the Egyptian chronology is, after a fashion, the greatest discovery in all of history. Egypt, the iron furnace, as it's called, purifies the crucible ore so that Egypt's chronology is not merely an end in itself. The gold it might produce is more precious than all of the gold of Tutankhamun's tomb, and more precious even than all of the silver of Susen's the first's tomb, worth more than gold. Is that a typo? I think that's a typo. Hang on a second here. Nope. Susen has an S at the end of his name. Okay. It's interesting. I never really noticed that before. The most learned Egyptologists of any era have not learned the key to the iron furnace, which is the Egyptian chronology, and cannot fire it up. Mr. Donald B. Redford dates Pharaoh Amenemhotep I earlier by 20 years than Mr.'s von Beckerath, Malik, and Arnold, since the one disagrees with the three regarding the latitude of the location of the observation of the rising of Sothis, a difference between Thebes late and Memphis early, this being the absolute reference date of Amenhotep's ninth year. The difference increases to 25 years by the time we arrive at the commencement of the reign of Thutmose III, which is later, the high date being, for him, 1504 BCE, Mr. Redford, as compared to 1479 BCE, except for perhaps the Assyrian history. Now, we date the commencement of Thutmose III in, where do we date him? Well, he changed his year one during the time of his reign, so it's either 1490 or 1493, as he later put it. He subsumed the reign of his father and of his aunt. So, as compared to 14... Okay, except for perhaps the Assyrian history, such disagreement is not considered very large for ancient dates generally. By the time of Tutankhamun, the spread is 23 years overall, and the 25-year chasm reappears by Ramesses II, Mr. Redford taking 1304 as his year one. Evidently, that's the same date taken by Krauss in the Ancient Egyptian Chronology book from 2006. But it was a typological error, a typographical error, I should say, typographical error of 1314 in that book. Early that's an early date, 1314. I mean 1304. But we take 1315, even earlier. But the later date is 1294 to 1279 for Ramesses II. But we cannot move Ramesses from 1315 because it fits perfectly with everything. In all the synchronisms with the Hittites and the eclipse during the time of one of the Hittite kings and so on, everything fits better for the crucible article, for the crucible chronology, for the chronology we use with Ramesses in 1315. So that's an exception where we go outside and above even the highest date of the Egyptologists. But at Smendes, spread in year one is 17 years across the board, with the lowest 1064 BCE versus 1081. And so we're still higher also at the time of Smendes with 1115. We're a lot higher. 1081 is Redford, and 1064 is Dodson in the Egyptological world. By the time of Shoshenq I, Mr. Redford, 931 BCE, year one for Shoshenq I, is the lowest. Mr. Redford's the lowest at that point, whereas he was the highest for Thutmose III. Mr. Redford is 931 for Shoshenq, and Mr. Aidan Dodson is the highest at 948 BCE. So they all place Shoshenq much lower in the BCE time period than we do, at 993. See, because Shoshenq is 993, with his year 5 having a WRS feast with a lunar alignment in 989, we can't put Shoshenq lower than 993 in our chronology, because we know what happened in the days of King Asa with the son of Shoshenq dying in the year 944, and all of this is interconnected. So because we can't lower or we can't lower Shawshank, but if we raise him, that makes it, you know, we could even possibly, we can't raise him much either because of the year five alignment there. So we don't really have much leeway for Shawshank, and that determines that we've got all the rest of it correct all the way back just to Smendes in 1115. We don't see any issues there. With discrepancies of this order, a day-for-day chronology appears impossible, and the situation quite disconcerting because of all the disagreements among the Egyptologists and the fact, of course, that we couldn't agree with them in the first place either, with any of our dates, just didn't fit with the all the facts. It didn't fit all the facts. We had to fit the facts. Today's proverb, little children, is Proverbs 14, 21, and 22. The man who despises his neighbor is bad, while he who has mercy on poor folk is glad. Devisers of evil things err, do they not? While makers of good will have truth as their lot. 2 Chronicles 23 is what happened with this young son, Joash, who had been hidden for 6 years. In the seventh year, Jehoiada showed himself courageous and proceeded to take the chiefs of hundreds, namely Azariah the son of Jeroham, and Ishmael the son of Jehohanan, and Azariah the son of Obed, and Maaseiah the son of Adaiah, and Elishaphat the son of Zichri, with him into the covenant. He took them into the covenant. Afterward they went around throughout Judah and collected together the Levites from all the cities of Judah and the heads of the paternal houses of Israel. So they came to Jerusalem. This is the time of Athaliah, the wicked queen, right? This is her year 7. We're looking for Moses now. Where is it? Let's see. We're very close. Here it is. Yeah, it's right here. There we go. Moses Part 2 article. The Part 2 of that article gives us the date. Ahaziah, who was killed by Jehu, as we read about in 2 Kings 9:27, actually. He was killed after 1 year of rule, and Athaliah ruled for 7 years from 886 to 879 in the Crucible chronology, the genealogy, as we call it also, or the BG, 886 to 879, 886 to 879 BCE. Athaliah, and then Jehoash, who rules for 40 years. He's the young son who begins, the son of Ahaziah, who begins to rule at the age of 7. Afterward, after they collected all these heads and they came to Jerusalem, then all the congregation concluded a covenant with the king in the house of the true God, the king being 7 years old, after which he said to them, look, this is the priest Jehoiada, the son of the king himself will reign just as Jehovah promised concerning the sons of David. This is the thing that you will do. One third of you who are coming in on the Sabbath of the priests and of the Levites will be for doorkeepers, and one third will be at the house of the king, and one third will be at the gate of the foundation. And all the people will be in the courtyards of the house of Jehovah. And do not let anyone enter the house of Jehovah but the priests and those of the Levites ministering. These are the ones that will enter because they are a holy group, and all the people themselves will keep the obligation to Jehovah. And the Levites must encircle the king all around, each one with his weapons in his hands. And as for anyone coming into the house, he should be put to death, and continue with the king when he comes in and when he goes out. And the Levites and all Judah proceeded to do according to all that Jehoiada the priest had commanded. So they took each one his men that were coming in on the Sabbath, together with those going out on the Sabbath. Now this is the interesting thing about the mention of the Sabbath. The priests served from Sabbath to Sabbath, so there were some that were commencing their duty on the Sabbath, and some were ending their duty on the Sabbath, and that's what's being referred to. For Jehoiada the priest had not set the divisions free from duty. Further, Jehoiada the priest gave the chiefs of hundreds the spears and the shields and the circular shields that had belonged to King David, which were in the house of the true God. And he went on to station all the people, even each one with his missal in his hand, from the right side of the house, clear to the left side of the house, by the altar and by the house, all around near the king. Then they brought the king's son out and put upon him the diadem and the testimony and made him king. And so Jehoiada and his sons anointed him and said, "Let the king live." This Bible we're using is the Protestant version, and it's an English translation of the Bible, containing the books that are approved in the order that's approved by the Protestant Bible, which was established, you know, at some point during the Protestant era, which began around 1520 of our era. So this version of the Bible, it's translated from the Masoretic text in many cases, whereas there's also the Septuagint version, which is the preferred version, actually, for most of what we do. But they don't differ in many cases. So we're content to use the one that's translated from the Masoretic text for most cases, or from some other manuscripts, but closely related, usually, to the Masoretic text. When Athaliah heard the sound of the people running and praising the king, she at once came to the people at the house of Jehovah. They were taking her rulership away from her. Then she saw, and there was the king standing by his pillar at the entry, 7 years old. And the princes and the trumpets by the king and all the people of the land were rejoicing and blowing the trumpets, and the singers with the instruments of song and those giving the signal for offering praise. Immediately Athaliah ripped her garments apart and said, "Conspiracy! Conspiracy!" But Jehoiada the priest brought out the chiefs of hundreds, the appointed ones of the military force, and said to them, "Take her out from inside the rows, and as for anyone coming after her, he should be put to death with the sword." For the priest had said, "You must not put her to death at the house of Jehovah." So they laid their hands upon her. When she came to the entry of the horse gate of the king's house, they at once put her to death there. Then Jehoiada concluded a covenant between himself and all the people and the king, that they would continue as the people of Jehovah. After that, all the people came to the house of Baal and pulled it down, Baal being a false god of the people of that same land of Canaan. And his altars and his images they broke up, and Matan, the priest of Baal, they killed before the altars. A lot of things were happening. Further, Jehoiada put the offices of the house of Yahweh, or Jehovah, in the hand of the priests and the Levites, whom David had put in divisions over the house of Jehovah to offer up the burnt sacrifices of Jehovah. The divisions that came in on the Sunday and went out, or on the Saturday rather. It's a Saturday that's the Sabbath. We, in the more modern church, we think of Sunday almost as being the Sabbath, but it's not. In the Jewish religion, the Saturday was the Sabbath, and they didn't have any special meaning for attached to the day of Sunday. So the divisions, the priestly divisions, came in on this Saturday, the Sabbath, and they went, and you know, and the ones from the previous week ended their duty on the same day that the new ones came in, the next division. So they replaced the divisions every week on the Sabbath day, which was Saturday. Okay. That's the divisions that were mentioned there to offer up the burnt sacrifices of Yahweh, according to what is written in the law of Moses, with rejoicing and with song by the hands of David. So he stationed the gatekeepers by, David had appointed these divisions. So he stationed the gatekeepers, and David, of course, lived much earlier. This is one of his descendants, the new king. So he stationed the gatekeepers by the gates of the house of Jehovah, that no one unclean in any respect might enter. The gatekeepers were positioned, and he now took the chiefs of hundreds and the lordly ones and the rulers over the people and all the people of the land, and brought the king down from the house of Jehovah. Then they came right through the upper gate to the king's house and seated the king upon the throne of the kingdom, and all the people of the land continued to rejoice, and the city itself had no disturbance. And Athaliah they had put to death with the sword. The wicked queen Athaliah, who had been the wife of Jehoram, and her son Ahaziah had ruled for 1 year, then been put to death, and she tried to, so that she could remain queen, she tried to wipe out the sons of her own son, Ahaziah, his sons she tried to kill. But Jehoash was now king at the age of 7 years old here. And we're running out of time if we don't jump ahead, so we're gonna have to look at Nahum right now, chapter 2 of Nahum. Let's see what we've got here. Nahum chapter 2. Right. Oh, this is still called a very magnificent thing. It says that the consequent desolation of Nineveh and the terror are all described, Adam Clark writes in his commentary, in the pathetic, vivid, and sublime imagery of Hebrew poetry. Nahum chapter 2. One that does a scattering has come up before your face. Let there be a safeguarding of the fortified place. Watch the way. Strengthen the hips. Reinforce power very much. This was described in chapter 1, verse 1 of Nahum as the pronouncement against Nineveh. For Jehovah will certainly gather the pride of Jacob, verse 2 of chapter 2, like the pride of Israel, because those emptying out have emptied them out, and the shoots of them they have ruined. The shield of his mighty men is dyed red. His men of vital energy are dressed in crimson stuff. Crimson stuff. It's a type of red, right? It's a shade of red. With the fire of iron fittings is the war chariot in the day of his getting ready, and the juniper tree spears have been made to quiver. In the streets, the war chariots keep driving madly. They keep rushing up and down in the public squares. Their appearances are like torches, like the lightnings. They keep running. He will remember his majestic ones. They will stumble in their walking. They will hasten to her wall, and the barricade will have to be firmly established. The very gates of the rivers will certainly be opened, and the palace itself will actually be dissolved. And it has been fixed. She has been uncovered. She will certainly be carried away, and her slave girls will be moaning like the sound of doves, beating repeatedly upon their hearts. And Nineveh, from the days that she has been, was like a pool of waters. But they are fleeing. Stand still, you men. Stand still. But there is no one turning back. Plunder silver, you men. Plunder gold, as there is no limit to the things in arrangement. There is a heavy amount of all sorts of desirable articles. Emptiness and voidness and a city laid waste, and the heart is melting, and there is a tottering of the knees, and severe pains are in all hips. And as for the faces of all of them, they have collected a glow of excitement. Where is the lair of lions and the cave that belongs to the maned young lions, where the lion walked and entered, where the lion's cub was, and no one was making them tremble? The lion was tearing to pieces enough for its whelps, or his whelps, and was strangling for his lionesses. And he kept his holes filled with prey and his hiding places with animals torn to pieces. Look, I am against you, is the utterance of Jehovah of armies, and I will burn up her war chariot in the smoke, and a sword will devour your own maned young lions, and I will cut off from the earth your prey, and no more will the voice of your messengers be heard. That's the end of Nahum chapter 2, talking about the city of Nineveh as compared to a lion which is tearing to pieces other, in the case of Nineveh and the Assyrians, they tore to pieces other kingdoms, they tore to pieces other nations, they tore people to pieces, and they captured and tortured or raped and did all sorts of things violent against other people and nations. People of other nations, and they did this as a way of maintaining their own religion or their own spirit, you know, about their own supremacy in their own, you know, cruelty. It was a very cruel people. They were very, very violent people, a violent nation. And Jehovah was about to execute vengeance. The allegory of the lion tearing to pieces it illustrates the nation of Assyria being like a lion, just a wild animal that kept keeping fresh meat available for its own people, so its people thrived on the bloodshed, you know, that the Assyrian kings carried out. That's the idea, the illustration. And the Insight book on Assyria says Assyria was essentially a military power. And the historical picture left of its exploits is one of great cruelty and rapaciousness. And that's what the reference is for that verse 11 of Nahum chapter 2, about the lair of lions, the lion being the one, you know, illustrating this violent nation of Assyria. So Jehovah was about to punish them. When he talks about the mighty men, verse 3, he's talking about, according to Adam Clark, the desolation and terror of the city of Nineveh. From verse 2, in fact. What about verse 5? Well, it doesn't give any guidance there. So, this is all part of talking about what happens to the city of Nineveh. You know, the spears are quivering. It's going to be a very violent destruction. Now, I'm trying to think what... Oh yeah, the year, the time that was of this prophecy. We saw previously this was after 711 or year 14 of Hezekiah that this prophecy was uttered, and Assyria wasn't finally destroyed until sometime in the 600s BCE. That's it for today's study. This is Monday, April 1st, 2024 of the Common Era, and the time is 1547 hours Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. In my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie saying bye for now.